A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to walk through the full life cycle of an imaginary international shipment. Stores Connecticut to Jerusalem. Kitchen goods. Split between air and sea. Tracking how modular units like Euro boxes consolidate onto pallets, then into containers. How customs works on both ends. What incoterm term we're shipping under. And how the whole thing breaks back down at the destination. It's basically the logistical equivalent of one of those cutaway diagrams of a submarine.
Which I love. This is the kind of thing where you read about pallets and containers and customs in isolation, but you never see how they actually fit together in sequence. And split shipments are the norm once you're moving anything more than a few boxes. You air freight the SKUs you need tomorrow and sea freight everything else. So this isn't a contrived teaching example. This is Tuesday.
Let's start in the warehouse. We've got a shipment of kitchen goods. Let's say we're a small direct-to-consumer brand that's expanding into the Israeli market. We've got about 2 cubic meters of product total. Some of it's small and dense. Knife sets, silicone spatulas, ceramic measuring spoons. Some of it's bulky. We've got a few stand mixers in retail packaging and 6 countertop ice cream makers. Those big ones are going to need to be palletized directly.
This is where the Eurobox enters the picture. So the standard Euro container system is built on a 400 by 600 millimeter footprint. That's the base module. You've got boxes in different heights, but they all nest and stack on that same footprint. The beauty of it is that a Euro pallet, which is 1200 by 800 millimeters, fits exactly 8 of those 4x6 boxes per layer. No wasted space, no overhang, nothing shifting in transit.
If you've been running a warehouse on that system, which I happen to know a thing or two about, you've already got everything slotted. The spatulas are in Euroboxes on shelf A3. The knife sets are in stackable 4x6s on shelf B1. When the order comes in, you're not scrambling for cardboard. You're pulling standardized units off the shelf.
So step one in our imaginary shipment, we do what's called pick and pack, but it's more like pick and stage. For the small dense items, we're pulling filled Euroboxes and staging them on the floor near the dock. For the larger items, the stand mixers and ice cream makers. Those are going to travel in their own retail packaging, but we need to get them onto pallets. So we're building 2 streams here. Stream A is the air freight, high priority SKUs, small volume, things we need in Jerusalem fast because we're launching and we can't have empty shelves. Stream B is the ocean freight, everything else, including all the bulky items.
Let's talk about what goes air versus what goes sea, because the logic isn't just send the expensive stuff by air. It's about inventory sequencing. If you're launching a product line in a new market, you need enough variety on day one to make the shelves look full. So your air shipment might be one of each SKU plus. Whatever your forecast says will sell out fastest in the first 2 weeks.
And the cost calculus is brutal. Air freight right now, mid-2026, is running somewhere around $4 to $6 per kilogram on the transatlantic plus Middle East leg. Ocean freight for a less-than-container-load shipment from the U.S. East Coast to Israel is maybe $150 to $200 per cubic meter. You're paying 20 to 30 times more for air. So you air freight the stuff that would cost you more in lost sales than the freight premium. The ice cream maker that retails for $300? That's going air if you only have 2 units and you need a demo model in Jerusalem. But the case of 50 spatulas? Those can take the slow boat.
We've staged our 2 streams. Stream A, the air freight, maybe 6 Euro boxes of small goods, plus 1 stand mixer in its retail box. Stream B, the sea freight, 40 Euro boxes, plus 5 ice cream makers and 4 stand mixers in original packaging. Now we need to palletize.
This is where it gets tactile. For Stream A, the air freight, your Euro boxes are already standardized, so you stack them on a pallet, probably not a full Euro pallet, actually. Air freight often uses smaller pallets or even just shrink-wrapped stacks, because you're paying by dimensional weight and every cubic centimeter matters. You might use what's called a half pallet, or even just build a custom stack, wrap it in about 15 layers of industrial cling film, and call it done.
Dimensional weight. Explain that quickly.
Airlines charge by whichever is greater, actual weight or volumetric weight. Volumetric weight is length times width times height in centimeters divided by 6,000, and that gives you a number in kilograms. So, a box of feather pillows that's physically large but light gets charged as if it weighs a lot. It's why air freight boxes tend to be dense and compact. You're penalized for shipping air.
Which is an excellent metaphor, but also literally true.
For the sea freight stream, we're building full pallets. Each pallet gets a layer of 8 Euro boxes, then another layer, maybe 4 or 5 layers high, wrapped and strapped. The bulky retail boxes get palletized on their own. The ice cream makers might sit 2 per layer on a standard Euro pallet, 3 layers high, strapped down. Everything gets a pallet label with a unique identifier, destination address, and a barcode that ties back to the packing list.
Now, here's a question. At this point, are we doing anything with customs, or is that downstream?
Customs starts now. Before anything leaves our warehouse, we need to provide our freight forwarder with a commercial invoice and a packing list. The commercial invoice lists every item, its harmonized system code, the HS code, its country of origin, its value, and the terms of sale. The packing list shows exactly what's in each box and on each pallet. The freight forwarder uses these to file what's called the Electronic Export Information through AES, the Automated Export System, which is the U.S. Customs and Border Protection System. Any shipment valued over $2,500 per item code requires an AES filing. Our kitchen goods are definitely over that threshold in aggregate.
The HS code. This is the 6-10 digit number that classifies every product for tariff purposes.
And getting it right matters enormously. A silicone spatula might be 3924.10. That's tableware and kitchenware of plastics. A stand mixer is 8509.40. Electromechanical domestic appliances with self-contained electric motor. If you misclassify, customs on either end can hold your shipment, fine you, or both. The freight forwarder usually handles classification, but the shipper is legally responsible.
We've handed our paperwork to the freight forwarder. What's a freight forwarder actually doing for us here?
The freight forwarder is the central nervous system of international shipping. They're not the carrier. They don't own the ships or planes. What they do is consolidate, coordinate, and navigate. For our shipment, they're going to take our pallets, combine them with pallets from other shippers heading to the same region, book space on a vessel or aircraft, handle the export filing, and manage the handoff to a customs broker on the Israeli side. Think of them as a travel agent who also packs your bags and handles your visa.
Our pallets leave stores, probably on a truck, heading to, what's the actual port of exit?
For ocean freight from Connecticut bound for Israel, the most likely routing is truck to the port of New York and New Jersey. That's the largest port on the East Coast and about a 2.5-hour drive from stores. The freight forwarder's consolidation warehouse is typically near the port. Our pallets arrive there and enter what's called a container freight station, a CFS.
This is where the consolidation magic happens.
This is where it gets interesting. Remember, we're shipping less than a container load, LCL. Our 2 pallets of kitchen goods are not filling a 40-foot container. That container costs maybe $3,000 to $4,000 to ship to Israel right now, and we're only using a fraction of it. So the freight forwarder combines our pallets with cargo from other shippers. Maybe someone's shipping bicycle parts to Tel Aviv. Another company's sending textile machinery to Haifa. All of it gets loaded into a single container, and we only pay for the cubic meters we use.
Which is the shipping equivalent of splitting an Uber.
And just like splitting an Uber, you don't control the route or the other passengers. Your pallet of spatulas might be sitting next to a crate of industrial lubricant. That's why packaging matters. Everything gets wrapped and strapped to survive a neighbor it wouldn't have chosen.
For the air freight stream, the process is similar, but faster and more expensive. Our small pallet goes to a forwarder's air consolidation facility, probably near JFK. Air freight consolidators are the masters of a dark art called building up an airway bill. They combine our 6 Euro boxes with other shippers' cargo onto a unit load device, a ULD, which is the aviation equivalent of a shipping container, shaped to fit the curve of an aircraft fuselage.
The time difference is stark. Our air freight pallet might leave stores on a Monday, be at JFK by Monday afternoon, get consolidated Monday night, fly out Tuesday morning, and land at Ben Gurion Airport by Wednesday. Customs clearance in Israel can happen within 24 hours for air freight. Our ocean freight is looking at 3 to 4 weeks.
Let's pause on the export customs moment. The AES filing happened. What actually gets checked?
For most consumer goods, nothing physically gets checked. The AES filing is processed electronically. U.S. Customs runs it through a risk assessment algorithm. They're looking for red flags, mismatched values, goods going to sanctioned entities, HS codes that don't match the declared commodity. Our shipment of kitchen goods is low risk, so it clears automatically. The container gets a customs release, and it can be loaded onto the vessel.
There's a random inspection possibility.
U.S. Customs targets something like 3 to 5% of containers for physical inspection. If your number comes up, they open the container, they may unload it partially or fully, they inspect, and then it all has to be reloaded. That can add 3 to 5 days and cost you hundreds of dollars in inspection fees, not to mention the delay. It's a lottery nobody wants to win.
Our ocean container is loaded, sealed, and on a ship. What's the actual route from New York to Israel?
The standard routing is transatlantic to a Mediterranean transshipment hub, then onward to Israel. The most common hubs are Piraeus in Greece, Limassol in Cyprus, or sometimes Gioia Tauro in southern Italy. The vessel leaves New York, crosses the Atlantic in about 8 to 10 days, offloads at the hub, and our container gets transferred to a feeder vessel, a smaller ship that runs the eastern Mediterranean loop. That feeder calls at Ashdod or Haifa, Israel's two main container ports. Total transit time, 18 to 25 days, port to port, plus a few more days for consolidation and deconsolidation on either end.
Ashdod versus Haifa. Which one are we heading to?
For Jerusalem, Ashdod is the closer port, about an hour's drive. Haifa is further north. Most containers bound for the Jerusalem area come through Ashdod. So our container is discharged at Ashdod port, and now we enter the Israeli customs process.
Which I've experienced.
Israeli customs is known for being meticulous. The process starts before the ship even arrives. Our freight forwarder has a partner in Israel, a customs broker who receives the bill of lading, the commercial invoice, and the packing list. The broker files an import declaration with the Israeli Customs Authority, classifying everything under the Israeli tariff schedule, which is harmonized with the international HS system but has its own rates and regulations.
Here's where the Incoterm we chose becomes the thing that determines who pays what and when.
Let's talk about Incoterms, because this is where a lot of small shippers get burned. Incoterms are the international commercial terms published by the International Chamber of Commerce. They define who pays for transport, who bears risk, and where responsibility transfers from seller to buyer. There are 11 of them, but for our scenario, the most likely choice is either FOB, free on board, or DAP, delivered at place.
Walk me through the difference.
If we ship FOB, our responsibility as the seller ends when the goods cross the ship's rail at the Port of New York, or in modern terms, when they're loaded onto the vessel. The buyer in Israel pays for the ocean freight, insurance, and handles import clearance. If we ship DAP, we as the seller are responsible for everything up to delivery at the named place in Jerusalem. We pay freight, we handle export clearance, but the buyer handles import clearance and pays duties.
In practice, for a small brand entering a new market, DAP is probably what you want. You control the logistics chain. You're not asking your new Israeli distributor to figure out how to get a container out of Ashdod.
And DAP gives you cost predictability. You quote a landed price to your buyer, and they're not surprised by freight charges or port fees they didn't anticipate. The trade-off is you're carrying the risk during transit. If the container falls off the ship, which happens more than people realize, about 1,400 containers are lost at sea annually. That's your loss under DAP, unless you purchase cargo insurance, which you absolutely should.
Always get the insurance. So, our container arrives at Ashdod. The customs broker files the import declaration. What happens next?
Israeli Customs reviews the declaration. They're looking at the declared value. Is it consistent with market prices for kitchen goods? They're checking the HS codes. Do the duty rates match the classification? They're verifying that the goods aren't subject to any import restrictions or special permits. Kitchen goods are straightforward, so this is usually a paperwork exercise. But Israel does have mandatory standards for certain categories. Electrical appliances need to meet Israeli Standards Institute requirements. Our stand mixers and ice cream makers, if they're being sold commercially, may need specific approvals.
This is where a lot of people get caught out. They assume that if something is legal to sell in the U.S., it's legal to import everywhere.
That's absolutely not true. Every country has its own standards regime. Israel's is particularly detailed for electrical goods. If our stand mixer doesn't have the appropriate testing certification, it could be held at the port indefinitely. The smart move is to check this before you ship, not after.
Let's say we did our homework. The import declaration clears. Customs assesses duties and VAT.
Israel's VAT is currently 17%, applied to the cost of the goods plus the cost of freight and insurance, the CIF value. Duties vary by HS code. Kitchen utensils might be 8 to 12%. Small electrical appliances might be 6 to 15%. The customs broker calculates the total, we pay it, or our broker pays it on our behalf and bills us, and the shipment is released.
Now we have a container sitting at Ashdod Port that's been customs cleared, but we're not taking delivery of a whole container. We're LCL.
So the container goes to a deconsolidation warehouse, a CFS on the Israeli side. The freight forwarder's partner opens the container, separates out all the different shippers' pallets, and ours gets staged for pickup. This is the mirror image of what happened in New York. Our two pallets of kitchen goods are extracted from the shared container, and they sit in a warehouse in Ashdod waiting for us.
Meanwhile, our air freight has already arrived. Let's rewind and track that parallel stream.
The air freight stream moves much faster, but the process is structurally similar. Our pallet went to JFK, got consolidated onto a ULD, and flew, probably on a passenger flight, actually. Most air freight moves in the belly of passenger aircraft. The Tel Aviv route is well served. LL, Delta, United, all fly direct from the New York area. Our kitchen goods are probably in the hold underneath someone's checked luggage.
Which is a wild thing to picture. Someone's watching a movie in business class while our spatulas are 3 meters below them in a pressurized cargo hold.
The flight is about 10 to 11 hours. The ULD lands at Ben-Gurion, gets offloaded, and goes to the air cargo terminal. The air waybill, the AWB, is the controlling document, and it moves electronically. The Israeli customs broker files an import declaration for the air shipment separately from the ocean shipment, even though they're part of the same commercial order.
Air customs clearance is faster?
Air freight is time-sensitive by definition. Israeli customs prioritizes it. Clearance can happen within hours. The broker files electronically, duties and VAT get assessed, payment is made, and the goods are released. The whole thing from touchdown to available for pickup can be under 24 hours.
Now we have two streams converging. The air freight has been in Jerusalem for 2 weeks already. We've unpacked it, shelved it, maybe already sold through some of it. The ocean freight has just cleared Ashdod. How does it get from Ashdod to Jerusalem?
The freight forwarder arranges what's called final mile delivery, or in this case, final 50 kilometers. A trucking company picks up our two pallets from the deconsolidation warehouse in Ashdod and drives them to Jerusalem. This is usually a straight truck with a lift gate. The driver has a delivery order that matches our shipment. The drive is about an hour, depending on traffic on Route 1.
Then the pallets arrive at our warehouse or fulfillment center in Jerusalem. This is the moment where all that standardization pays off.
This is the payoff. The pallets come off the truck. Because we used Euro boxes on Euro pallets, everything is dimensionally predictable. The pallets slot directly into standard racking. The boxes are labeled with the same SKU system we used in stores. We cut the shrink wrap, pull the boxes off the pallet, and they go straight onto shelves. No repacking, no relabeling, no what's in this box guesswork.
The stand mixers and ice cream makers in their retail packaging get broken down differently. Those go to a separate staging area where they're either cross-docked for immediate delivery to retail partners or slotted into larger shelving units.
This is where the split shipment strategy really proves itself. While the ocean freight was in transit for 3 weeks, the air freight was already on shelves, generating revenue, proving the market. By the time the bulk shipment arrives, we have actual sales data. We know which SKUs are moving fast and which are slow. We can adjust our shelving plan accordingly. The air freight wasn't just a bridge shipment, it was a market test.
Let's circle back to something we glossed over, the cost breakdown. What does this whole operation actually cost?
Let's rough it out. Our ocean shipment is about 1.5 cubic meters, maybe 300 kilograms. LCL ocean freight from New York to Ashdod, roughly $300 to $450. Export customs filing, maybe $50 to $75. Insurance, maybe 1% of declared value, so if our goods are worth $10,000, that's $100. Israeli customs broker fee, around $200 to $300. Duties and VAT, that's on the goods value, but let's say roughly $1,500 to $2,000 all in. Final mile trucking, maybe $250. Total ocean leg, somewhere around $2,500 to $3,500, not including the actual duties and VAT, which are a pass-through.
The air freight?
Air freight for our priority stream, maybe 60 kilograms, a third of a cubic meter, is probably running $800 to $1,200. The customs broker fee is similar, maybe a bit less because the entry is simpler. Final mile is cheaper because it's smaller. Total air leg may be $1,500 to $2,000.
Combined, we're looking at $4,000 to $5,000 in logistics costs to move maybe $15,000 worth of kitchen goods from Connecticut to Jerusalem. That's a significant percentage.
It is, and this is why scale matters. If we were shipping a full container load, the per unit cost drops dramatically. A 40-foot container to Israel might cost $4,000 all in, but if you fill it with 60 cubic meters of goods worth $150,000, your logistics cost as a percentage of goods value drops from 30% to under 5%. LCL is convenient but expensive per cubic meter.
Which is the classic small importer trap. You're paying a premium for flexibility.
There's another cost we haven't mentioned, demurrage and detention. Demurrage is what the port charges you if your container sits at the terminal beyond the free time, which is typically 3 to 5 days. Detention is what the shipping line charges if you keep their container beyond the allowed free days after pickup. For LCL, demurrage on your pallet sitting in the CFS works similarly. You get a few free days, then storage charges kick in. If your customs clearance gets delayed, those fees add up fast.
The clock is ticking from the moment the ship docks. Your broker needs to be on it.
A good broker is worth their weight in gold. They know the customs officers. They know which HS codes are getting scrutiny this month. They know when to push and when to wait. The difference between a shipment clearing in 2 days versus 2 weeks is often the broker.
Let's talk about what can go wrong, because the smooth path we've described is aspirational.
Where do you want to start? The container misses the transshipment connection in Piraeus and sits on the dock for a week. The customs officer decides the declared value looks low and requests a valuation review. The Standards Institute flags the ice cream maker as requiring additional testing. The truck from Ashdod breaks down on the Jerusalem road. The pallet gets damaged during deconsolidation and 3 Euro boxes are crushed.
The air freight, the flight gets delayed, the ULD gets misrouted, the customs broker system goes down on a Friday afternoon before Shabbat, and nothing moves until Sunday.
Every single one of these has happened to someone I know. The key is building buffer into your timeline and budget. If your launch date depends on the ocean shipment arriving in exactly 21 days, you're already in trouble. Plan for 30, celebrate if it's 21.
The Incoterm we chose, DAP. Also means we're carrying the risk for all of those failure modes during transit. If we'd shipped EXW, X Works, the buyer would bear all risk from our warehouse door. But for a small brand entering a new market, EXW is basically saying good luck to your buyer. Not a great relationship builder.
There's a middle ground that's becoming more popular, especially for e-commerce brands, DDP, Delivered Duty Paid. The seller handles everything, including import duties and taxes, and the buyer just receives the goods. It's the most buyer-friendly term, but it requires the seller to be registered for VAT in the destination country, which is an administrative hurdle.
For our hypothetical kitchen goods brand, DAP is the sweet spot. We control the logistics, we pay the freight, we get the goods to Jerusalem, and the buyer handles import duties. It's clear, it's fair, it's standard.
It's what most freight forwarders are comfortable with. They can quote you a DAP rate without blinking.
Let's zoom out. What's the big lesson from tracking this entire life cycle?
The big lesson is that international shipping isn't one process. It's about 15 processes that have to happen in sequence, each dependent on the one before it, spread across multiple companies, multiple countries, and multiple modes of transport. The reason standardization matters. Euroboxes, ISO pallets, shipping containers, HS codes, encoder mounds, is that without it, the handoffs between those processes would be chaos.
Every handoff is a point of failure. Standardization reduces the surface area of those handoffs.
When you hand a Eurobox to a freight forwarder, they know exactly what they're dealing with. It fits on their pallets, it fits in their racking, it stacks predictably. When you use a recognized Incoterm, the responsibilities are unambiguous. When you classify with the correct HS code, customs on both ends processes it without friction. The entire system is built on mutual recognition of standards.
The split shipment strategy, A plus C, is really a recognition that time and cost are both dimensions of logistics, and you can optimize across them if you plan carefully. The air freight buys you speed and market intelligence. The ocean freight buys you scale and margin. Together, they're a complete go-to-market logistics strategy for a small brand.
One last detail that's worth mentioning. The documentation doesn't end when the goods arrive. You need to retain all of this. The commercial invoice, the bill of lading, the air weigh bill, the import declaration, the customs payment receipts, for at least 5 years. Israeli tax authority can audit import records, and if you can't produce the paperwork, you're in trouble.
The least exciting part of international shipping, and somehow the most important.
That's logistics in a sentence, really.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1780s, French naturalists exploring the seamounts off Djibouti documented over 80 species of reef fish found nowhere else on Earth. An early glimpse of seamount endemism, driven by the same geological isolation that had, entirely by accident, turned those underwater mountains into de facto marine nature reserves centuries before anyone thought to protect them.
The French accidentally created marine parks by just not being able to reach them.
Conservation through inconvenience. I'll take it.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtob. If you enjoyed this, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps other people find the show. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.